Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we read Judy Blume's new adult novel about catastrophes and families. And in our second segment, we visit the Lifetime drama series Unreal, which is set in a real fictional environment about which we know just a little bit. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We are reading and unreeling this week, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we are joined by a very special guest this week. We have shipped her in all the way from Boston because this show has to do with both books and The Bachelor, so this can only be with us.
It's pretty much in my contract.
The wonderful Margaret H. Willison. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi, Linda.
So when you're not appearing on Pop Culture Happy Hour, what exactly do you do with yourself?
For love and money, I'm a librarian. And for love alone, I am the host of the best 24/7 slumber party on Twitter and one half of the Two Bossy Dames newsletter.
That's right. You absolutely are. Two Bossy Dames killing it these days. Like it very much. Very much enjoying my subscription to your newsletter. So the first thing we wanted to talk about this week is the Judy Blume novel. In the unlikely event, I feel like it's only right to have Margaret in our midst while we talk about this. The book is set in Elizabeth, New Jersey in late 1951 and early 1952, and it follows several fictional families through a real historical event, which was three commercial plane crashes that took place in less than 2 months in the same city near Newark Airport. As you can imagine, this set off a lot of complicated emotions in the community where Judy Blume, who is now 77 years old and who many of us have been reading for decades, really lived as a kid. So in the book, there is a girl named Miri, her mother Rusty, her grandmother Irene, who are sort of at the center of the story. They're surrounded by various friends and relatives, as well as Miri's first love, I would say. Obviously, all of this is kind of unsettled by this series of accidents. And also, as one additional piece of background, in case we refer to it later, I got to talk to Judy Blume about this book at an event in D.C. a while ago. So if I say Judy Blume told me, I'm not hallucinating, as a matter of fact, for once. So let me ask you, Margaret, about your reaction to In the Unlikely Event.
I really enjoyed it. My mileage with books written for adults after 1952 varies.
That's true.
But this felt, although it was written for adults, felt very similar to a lot of books written for children in all the best ways. A lot of emotional immediacy, a snappy but not overly propulsive plot, and just it took seriously the emotions and journeys of everybody in the book.
For those of you, if you're not familiar, Judy Blume had a very active career, particularly in the late 1970s and 1980s, writing what would now probably be considered YA, which was not a thing at the time. They were children's books. And she wrote, you know, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which is probably, I would argue, her most famous. She wrote Blubber and Dini and
Forever.
And Wifey.
Forever and Wifey,
yeah.
Which we've talked about on this show. She has branched out into both Forever, which is kind of a sexually frank book about teenagers, and then Wifey, which is a very sexually frank book about bored wife, very much coming out of kind of the atmosphere of the 70s and 80s. But she's then gone back and written a number of books for adults in the last couple decades. Glenn, what did you think of this book?
Well, this is only my second Judy Blume book. I only read one of hers when I was a kid, and that was a book called Then Again, Maybe I Won't, which is actually one of the few books, if not only, book she wrote from the point of view of a boy.
Yeah.
And my mom gave it to me when I was 11, and that book is all about erections.
A lot of it is, yeah.
And it's the reason for a period of time between 1980 and 1985 I was unable to look my mother in the eye.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Look, I can admire the craft of this book. I can respect that it's well put together. And I can also say, unequivocally, that what Vermeer is to light, Judy Blume is to internal conflict.
Sure.
Like this, the clash of the id and the superego, what we want versus what we think we should want or what we want to tell everybody else we want, that clash, that's her medium. That's basically what she does in a kind of adolescent way. The prose is clear, it's unshowy, it's almost journalistic,
yeah.
And the details that she brings up are very prosaic, very small. I like to work a little bit harder
yeah.
when I'm reading a book, and I know how pompous that sounds, but I mean,
I kind of get what you're saying.
I kind of want things to be, for me to be more involved, for me to do more. I kept waiting for this book to deepen, to complicate, to surprise. Never happened for me. And, you know, for things like the period detail, for example. So there are certain things that she uses as signifiers of the 50s, which are perfectly accurate. Things like the Angora sweaters and Uncle Milty. The thing is, though, that those signifiers have been used a lot by now. So very rarely did I find something that seemed like it could still resonate. Like it happened with Rusty, the Miri's mom, sells Volupte compacts.
Yeah.
That I keyed into. That's a detail that seemed alive.
I agree. That's a great detail.
It's a great detail. The rest of the stuff just was sort of, it just didn't pop off the page for me. There is a point very early in this book. It seems like we could be introducing an element of the uncanny, something kind of vaguely spiritual.
Right.
I kind of felt myself, my whole being, because I kind of like that kind of stuff, wanting the book to do that. The book didn't do
that. Yeah.
What it really did well is it established this community, feeling this sense of threat. I like this idea of what do people do when they feel like doom is at hand. What they ended up doing wasn't particularly interesting to me.
Yeah, no, I understand that. How about you, Stephen?
You know, it's interesting. I read almost all of Judy Blume's books in the 70s and 80s. Like, when I was a kid and a teenager, she was my go-to author, and I read a crap ton of her books. And then once I was, you know, out of, I don't know, middle school or high school, I mean, I definitely read the hell out of Forever and Wifey. You know, I got away from reading her stuff, and she's been writing books in the interim. It was very interesting to go back decades later and read a, you know, 400-page adult novel by Judy Blume and still feel some of the same themes coming up in interesting ways. Mm-hmm. Judy Blume is an expert chronicler of the lives of normal people who feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
That makes her particularly good, I think, at channeling adolescence. She'll look at fairly straightforward lives, but capture, as you were kind of saying, Glenn, all that inner turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, she is able to successfully transplant that into the early 50s. I had, I think, a little bit more problem with the period detail than you did, particularly in the beginning of this book, where she's unfurling character after character after character in the midst of this clot of just very nuts and bolts detail. The Volupte compact is a nice detail, but there's also a lot of, like, she sits there with her, you know, such and such brand.
The slips, the garments.
Yeah. But for me, it slowed down the plot. And once I think she kind of dispenses with that after about, I don't know, 50, 75 pages, then it starts to, it's not necessarily like hugely plot driven. It's not telling like a massive story. It's more this analysis of the way that all these people are keeping secrets. And now in the 50s, turned out they're about secrets. That for me, it got more propulsive and the pages turned more quickly.
Yeah. It does emerge, I think. Not until close to the end did I feel like I got my arms around what I think is the theme of the book, and which is the purpose of writing the book about these plane crashes, which is she is taking these three plane crashes, which are such a bizarre event. I am surprised that I didn't know this story, because what a weird, can you imagine in current day, the age of Twitter, three plane crashes in one city in 2 months.
Three commercial airlines.
Commercial airlines. Like, not, now granted, you know, flying perhaps is safer now and it's more of a freak occurrence. I don't know that. But certainly this town was not, you know, prepared for anything like this. And so I think she uses this freak occurrence and the desire of the town to find some link between these things that will explain them. I think what emerges is that part of what she's writing about is the lack of through lines in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that happen in the book. It's very true of the story of Miri and this boy that she begins dating, that there's no sort of purpose, and this makes it sound negative, and I mean it positive. There's no kind of planned narrative thrust necessarily to what happens in that story, except to demonstrate what I think the title in The Unlikely Event is sort of about, which is, you know, sometimes the most, like, a little thing that, you know, you don't necessarily think is gigantic becomes something that just resonates with people for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And things, the whole direction of what you're doing changes because, you know, you run into a different person or you have an opportunity to build a different kind of relationship with somebody. And so I appreciated where I felt it converging thematically, which was around this idea of the way small happenings kind of pile up in somebody's life.
I mean, she's also, and this is, I remember this from a bunch of Judy Blume books, especially the ones that are geared toward a little bit older readers, is she's very careful to lay out across her many books that virtually every one of these characters has, like, makes a bad decision at some point. She's very careful not to really to paint anyone as a saint or somebody who has really gone without some sort of skeleton in their closet. And again, it's part of what makes her so good at writing for kids is sort of establishes, like, everybody screws up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I think kind of one of the themes of this book is one of the reasons that so many people screw up is nobody's talking about their
right.
problems. Nobody's
mm-hmm.
sharing. Nobody's
right.
really giving it, like, passing down a rule book because nobody's really talking about anything.
Right.
Not that, you know, we're all flawless today because we talk
no,
more.
No.
Or
but
share
she
more.
But she did say to me that one of the kind of ideas behind this book is that what she remembers of that experience as a kid, what she remembered was nobody talking about it, which is partly what led the kids to speculate.
Sure.
You know, she talks
mm-hmm.
about how the boys were very into the idea that it was sabotage and, you know, that clearly, and you can sort of understand how
mm-hmm.
they got there.
Yeah.
And a couple of these plane crashes happened very close to schools and orphanages. And so she talked about how, you know, people felt like, is this something that is sabotage that is aimed at kids?
Right.
Because they really seemed to have been narrow misses. You know, so she talks about that very theme of secrecy that you're talking about, Stephen, where, like, nobody talks about what's going on, so everybody is kind of filling in their own thing. And I think that's certainly the way she's always approached sort of life, that if you mm-hmm. don't talk about it, then you wind up like Glenn Lott looking your mother in the eye for 5 years because you do not want to talk
about
erections.
Well,
yeah.
Glenn might have done that no matter what.
That's true. Yeah. It's true.
I was going to return back to a point that Glenn made earlier about wanting to work harder while you read the book. When you were saying that, I was like, that's where you and I differ as readers. But more to the point, when I was reading this book, I was sort of experiencing it, and it felt like a book about adults that a teenager might really enjoy, but not necessarily a book about teenagers that an adult would, like, really click into. And the thing it reminds me most of is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith and Joy in the Morning, because it starts rooted in the adolescent experience and it takes that very seriously and it deals with it gently. But then it also lets you follow these characters up until they grow up. And that's one of the things that the market segmentation you get in fiction right now doesn't allow. Because we have such a clearly defined YA novel. It's like once you get to the end of that YA novel, it's like maybe they're going to college.
Right.
Maybe they aren't. But that's the end of their story. And this idea,
or it
that
seems,
like,
kind of tacked on, like the people say, I'm not a Harry Potter person, but, like, what people sort of said about some of the epiloguing of Harry Potter was
I've erased that from my memory.
Right. No, of course. But you see what I'm saying.
Yes. So in this case, it's really refreshing to have a situation where you start with Miri's teen years and they're given incredible weight. And then you have this end bit. I do think it is cohesive, where you get to spend a little bit of time with her as an adult and see where all these things fall into perspective.
Yeah.
And I know for me that was really helpful when I read these Betty Smith books when I was 14. And I feel like that's something you don't get as much in fiction now.
Yeah, she uses the same very close third-person narrator throughout as she's going through all these different people's heads. There's like 12 or 15 different characters, right? We see a lot, maybe.
Sure.
Do not put this book down and try to come back to it two days later.
Yeah.
You want to power through because there's just a lot of people. And one of the reasons I had that problem with it is because I don't think the voices that she's going, they're not distinct enough. They're not fully fleshed out so that somebody's voice sounds different. There is this sameness, and there is also this weird structural thing, right? Almost to the middle of the book, where all of a sudden we have a chapter that's not about the individual people from their heads. It's got a bunch of headlines like distraction, rumors, a condolence call to Mrs. Spoiler, visitation, Shiva, interview. What is that doing there? I thought, okay, I understand what it's doing there. It's she wants to back way the hell up to like 30,000 feet and give you a good view of this town.
Right.
But she's using exactly the same very close third-person narrator. I didn't understand what we were getting from this, that particular chapter, that we wouldn't have gotten if she just used the same format before with all the different names and all the different people. It's just me.
No. I understand that. I think you're right that I think there is a kind of a structural, I don't want to say chaos, but there's a structural disorder to it in places just because there is so much going on. I did find that the more it fractured, right, and the more people we were following, and I think this happens in any book like this, you have the people that you want to get back to and more enjoy the story of these people than those people, either because you find their voices more distinctive or you find the stories that are happening to them more compelling or you relate to them more or you simply find them easier to follow. Mm-hmm. I think she's trying to kind of put her arms around a lot of things about the stuff that she feels like people weren't talking about in the 50s. So there's a lot in here about kind of sexual mores and family stuff. And when Stephen talked about everybody screwing up, she's willing to touch certain third rails in terms of characters screwing up that not everybody does, even when they write a book where everyone has flaws. There are things that she's willing to kind of play around with here with characters that you're meant to be very sympathetic with that you wouldn't get in every, I think, book like this. I did really enjoy it. I was working very hard on, obviously, preparing to talk to her as I was reading it, so it's not a very normal reading experience.
Sure.
I so appreciate what Margaret referred to as the emotional immediacy of the way that she writes. And I get what Glenn is saying. I'm not suggesting Glenn is asking for decorative prose, but it is undecorative prose in some ways.
Deliberately so.
And I think it is deliberately so. Mm-hmm. And I think it's legitimately just, I like to have some books like this in my life. I like to have other books that are a little more kind of stylistic, what I would consider to be stylistic.
Yeah, I think one of the effects of that fairly plain-spoken prose and of having so many characters is you do have a little bit of this process of like, oh, now who is this person? Oh, they're getting on a plane. They're screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that did begin to happen to me. Well, you realize, I think.
And every once in a while, you're like, don't get on a plane.
Well, and I think some of it's intentional in the sense that you, if you've kind of read even the description of the book, you kind of know that these crashes are coming and you do begin to see kind of the world begins to coalesce around this coming disaster. And I think that's intentional, probably.
I did jump ahead to the author's note to just affirm, one, that this was real, and two, how many crashes there were. Because, I didn't want to get a fake out where, we were visiting with somebody who was getting on an airplane and I was very anxious about them, and then they were fine.
Yeah, I want to know when I can stop worrying about people dropping dead all the time.
One of the things that I asked her was kind of what the research was that went into the historical side of this. And she basically said absolutely everything about the crashes.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything about the planes, absolutely everything about where the planes wound up. You know, there's a sense in one of the crashes that perhaps the pilot intentionally steered the plane away from schools because he had a familiarity with the area. That all comes, as I understood from her, from the actual story.
But these characters are all fictionalized.
Absolutely.
That was why I peeked ahead. I'm like, how sad should I be?
Yeah, and I agree with Margaret that I really enjoyed that little time jump. I enjoyed that little...
Yeah.
It's a tricky thing to pull off because it can feel like you're kind of bestowing blessings or not on people many decades later.
And that little boy whom nobody
exactly
loved.
Well,
to be.
Or kind of do things turn out okay for this person or not? And
if you've...
You know, there are lots of books where you get a little bit of that. Even in... I always think about Stand By Me when I get things like this where they kind of give you endings, which are very different in the book and the movie, by the way. They give you endings for these people. And that's a tough thing to do as an author because you've come to really care about these characters and then you have to sort of decide, like, well, who makes it, you know? And not just who makes it in terms of who lives, but, like, who comes out okay and how okay are they?
Yeah, and I realized how attached I was to certain characters when it got to that point. I was really happy to have resolutions for so many of those people.
Right, and to see kind of how they relate to each other and what relationships have held up and what ones haven't. I think it's an interesting book. Well, I will be interested to see what those of you who have read the book thought of it. And you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at NPRPCHH or on the blog. And we will talk to you about your impressions and whether it felt like a Judy Blume book to you, if you, of course, were in the habit of reading them. When we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about a television show called Unreal, which has been airing on Lifetime. We'll be talking about that in a moment. So we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Josh, and I'm calling from Azusa, California. Fifth Generation, maker of Tito's Handmade Vodka. Tito Beverage, yes, that's his real name, incorporates the concepts of artisan craftsmanship found in boutique wineries into the spirits industry to create Tito's Handmade Vodka. Tito still uses the time-honored pot still batch distillation process at the original distillery where he started it all, in Austin, Texas. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from corn and is naturally gluten-free.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You know, there are some weeks when we find a little bit of a through line between our first segment and our second segment. This is not one of those weeks, with the exception of the fact that this is a topic that was originally brought to me by a couple of different people, one of whom was Margaret Willison. What we're going to talk about next is the show Unreal, which airs on Lifetime, and it concerns a young woman named Rachel, played by Sherry Appleby, who works on a show that is not The Bachelor, but is The Bachelor.
It's The Schmatchler.
It is The Schmatchler. Not only because it's The Schmatchler in form and it has The Bachelor down beat for beat, I think very accurately in many ways, but also because the woman who created it, whose name is Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, worked on The Bachelor. Yep. So, and has talked about this being, you know, not so loosely based on her experience, perhaps, as she describes it. It originally was a short film called Sequin Rays, which it's available. You can rent it on Vimeo. I rented it and watched it. It's a brief look at an interaction between this producer and one cast member in which the producer is sort of forcing out these very painful things from this cast member, who's played, by the way, by Anna Camp. Mm. And the producer is in the movie is Ashley Williams, who was the cupcake girl on How I Met Your Mother, if that means anything to you. Anyway, the point being, that is kind of this one little experience. In Unreal, it's a much bigger look at the entire show, all the people. The guy they do not call The Bachelor, they call him The Suitor. Yep. Because, you know,
you got to call him something, and they can't call him The Bachelor.
So you get a lot of reflecting on this world that this woman lives in which she's forced to try to create emotionally scarring moments from people. So let me ask you, Stephen.
Yeah.
It's not a secret. You and I are both Bachelor people.
Though I will say this is what I have watched in lieu of the current season of The Bachelorette, I watched for the first couple episodes, and then it became really clear that the theme of this season was going to be all about slut shaming.
It's true.
And
there is some truth to that.
So I have actually opted out of this season of The Bachelorette, and I'm watching this instead, a kind of a cartoony, occasionally satire of The Bachelor. It seems a little amplified in highlighting the show's flaws. And it's interesting because on paper, this show does not interest me at all. It's like, we're going to really stick it to The Bachelor, which is just such a big, fat, juicy target. It's been around for close to 15 years and has been very, very heavily satirized even by itself. Like, it's even like The Bachelor spinoffs are, as we've talked about on the show before, very trashy versions of The Bachelor.
And we've already had Burning Love, the web series with Ken Marino and a bunch of other people, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and I was kind of dreading this. It just didn't look interesting to me as someone who's like, this comes pre-skewered. Mm-hmm. And yet I found this show really addictive. And I watched one, I was like, yeah, I'd watch that again. And then I watched the second one, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to watch the next one. And then I just, boom, boom.
Yeah.
The first four episodes were kind of dropped all at once,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But now we're in this endless wait for episode five.
Yeah. Now Thompson's hurting. Now, this is my moment of truth with this show. And I'm genuinely very curious. Because Margaret has already, had recommended it to me originally and was interested in it. Steve and I have now been made aware likes it. Speak to me. Glenn Weldon, Mr. Non-Bachelor, Mr. Non-Lifetime.
I don't watch The Bachelor. I never will watch The Bachelor. Sure. I prefer my reality shows to have some modicum of skill and craft in them, as long as that skill and craft isn't emotionally manipulating people and being vapid.
Right.
Like your Top Chefs, your Project Runways, your RuPaul's Drag Races, all of those are about competition
of
actual...
Your boutique reality
Your
television.
Boutique reality television.
Sure.
I love this.
Nice.
It is cynical. It is hard-bitten. It is unforgiving. These are not words I associate with the Lifetime brand. I've read a couple of reviews were saying, but it also has a heart.
No, it doesn't. Nobody's likable at all.
What it has, though, and it's surprising, is empathy.
Exactly. That's
humanity.
What I think. That's what I think.
What is happening are these cardboard cutouts you meet in the first episode, we start to understand where they're coming from in a very real way. Also, because this is such a weird, highly specific, niche little situation, we get emotional dynamics that we have never seen on television before. The idea that there is a woman who is great at her job and that job is possibly destroying her soul is something we've just never seen before. Now, you could argue that you saw it in Mad Men, right? Because Don Draper was great at his job.
Yeah.
And you could argue, and I would, that it was destroying him. Matthew Weiner would not agree with you because Matthew Weiner believes that advertising is noble and creative and blah, 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 blah. But it's fascinating to me. I mean, it's Burning Love is a lot funnier and broader. And I think The Comeback is kind of swims in some of these same waters, and I think it's gayer, but it's also, I think, a little smarter. I worry that, exactly as Stephen pointed out, that there are people who dismiss all of reality television as the great, you know, people who use the word nadir. and that's coming from a kind of a lazy place of judgment, and this seems like it could feed into that. Like, people who don't make the distinction that, say, I make between the different kinds of reality.
No, of course. But
they could just say, oh, and it is like shooting fish in a barrel, but because the characters, I'm really in.
Yeah, I agree with you. How about you, Margaret?
I would say, you know, the opposite of Stephen. My enjoyment of The Bachelorette this season is being propelled specifically by my enjoyment of Unreal. They are really better together because there have been a couple of moments that mirror very closely interactions on the show. And what I'd say is there is some granular satire that's really good on Unreal. Like, there's a dynamic between a black producer and the two black female contestants and conversations that happen between them. That feels true and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's some sort of bluntly soapy stuff that's happening in the same sphere. There's, like, a character who has a rough thing happen in her own life, and there's ambiguity about whether she's going to be allowed to go home to her family, and that doesn't feel plausible to me, and it pushes me out of the Unreal story a little bit.
Sure.
But as they've been amping up sort of the soapy aspects native to the production team, their misrepresentation of sort of like what production of a reality TV show is like is bothering me less, and I'm finding it super addictive.
I agree with Glenn. I don't think you have to necessarily believe that everything they say about the way a show like this is made is absolutely true. I suspect some of it's true. I don't think you have to believe that it's not exaggerated. This is exactly what happens behind the scenes at The Bachelor. Look, she worked there, blah, blah, blah. Right. I don't think you have to buy into it at that level. What I love about it, and when Glenn said empathy, I was so glad because what it has for me is it just posits, right? You look at all these people and it sort of says, how would this happen? Like, how would all these things that seem to make no sense, that no human would act this way, how do you create humans who act this way and who make these choices? And they do such a good job of creating types, especially the women who are cast on the show, types who really exist. The one who is pushed to be the old, desperate woman who is going to be cast as kind of, you know, she's just cannon fodder. And eventually they're just going to say, oh, she's too old. That has certainly happened on The Bachelor.
Yeah.
But then they make her a person, and she has an opinion about how far she wants to go and how far she doesn't want to go. And it's similar. I think Margaret was very smart to bring up the story of the two black women who have kind of very different responses to the way the show wants to push the idea of being a black woman on The Bachelor, which, you know, certainly is a thing.
Yeah, I actually should take back something I said earlier when I was like, there's nobody who's likable on this show. None of the central characters I find particularly likable. But I do feel an enormous amount of sympathy for the female cast of the show, who are by far the most certainly put upon, and in some cases very nobly intentioned, people in this group. I mean, I almost felt like there's almost like a Breaking Bad feeling to this show, where you're seeing people who are prone to compromising their values still hitting slipperier and slipperier and slipperier slopes.
Right.
You know, one decision they make, with the wardrobe in this show, in the very first, I think it's the first shot of the series, you see the Rachel character wearing a t-shirt that says, "This is what a feminist looks like."
Yeah, it's very early in that first episode.
And
incidentally,
it is the establishing shot of her.
And they clearly do that to establish up front, this is somebody who in her life has these values, and in her job has to have these values.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now, spoiler, the job values constantly went out.
But they give the reasons why that would happen.
Right.
They give reasons why she would feel forced.
But they don't
that her
seem
hand
like
was forced.
Excuses. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
I agree. I don't think this is the kind of show where Sherry Appleby is going to get nominated for things.
No, but
I wish she would. Mm-hmm. I think this performance is so hard. And it is not flashy. It is not a big performance. It is not a loud performance. It is not a performance with lots of yelling and screaming and heavy emoting. It is a performance with a lot of resignation in it, which
yes.
can be a really hard thing to make compelling. It's also a performance with a lot of just biting back embarrassment that she feels about things that have happened in the past while she's been working on the show. It's a really contained performance that I think is just really, really excellent.
It's also a wonderfully unglamorous performance. I mean, you have this, it's this great scene and it's done entirely, you're just seeing it happen, of her like trying to clean herself up in like a storage closet
I think it's in a production van maybe.
Yeah, and yeah. So, and you see her like, and it's such a wonderful little detail. She needs to put on deodorant, but the deodorant is basically empty, and she takes the tip of her finger and scrapes out some of the...
Everybody's done it.
Yes. and just scrapes them out and then reaches her hand under, I think, that same t-shirt in order to apply deodorant with her fingers. And you just get a sense of like how unglamorous her life is in that lovely little detail.
Yeah. I also like the performance from Constance Zimmer, who plays
the she's
boss.
Great.
Boy, that's a role that you go 2 degrees
exactly.
too far, and
right.
that role is just dragon lady,
right.
dumb jerk. I mean, she's introduced, the boss is introduced, essentially, being a racist.
Hello there.
Hi.
I'm Shamiqua.
Shamiqua.
Yeah.
Okay, there
cut.
We go. I think I got it.
Cut. Cut. That's a cut. That's a cut. Everybody back to ones, please. Let's hustle.
Damn it. Shamiqua? That's your girl? That's the one who you said had wife potential? She's black.
She's gorgeous. She went to Spelman.
Okay, you know what? First girl out of the carriage is always a wifey, and that is not a wifey.
There is a black man in the White House.
Oh, thank you so much. I know, okay? And he's barely black, all right? It is not my fault that America's racist, people.
Do you find, Linda, as you watch The Bachelorette, has its vision of how the producers work gotten into your head and started with meta-analysis?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So there have been two noteworthy racially tinged meltdowns.
Charged meltdowns.
On the show this season. And you watch that and you think of the producer conversation in Unreal and you just think, God, like, what did the producers do to these guys to get them to explode like this?
Well, starved them and fed them drinks.
And they're very smart about that, I think, on this show.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. It's made watching The Bachelorette more appealing, which is a real problem.
Every time I talk about quitting The Bachelor on this damn show, I get pulled back in.
Yeah, well, no, but there's the other thing. You know, one of the things I think that they do that's really, really smart, and that I do think comes clearly from her experience, is that when you talk about reality shows, quote unquote, people tend to think of it as a binary, right? On the one hand, it's these are totally authentic experiences where this is just like people being normal, right? Mm-hmm. At the other extreme, people say, oh, it's all scripted. It's all fake.
Right.
Like, they're just faking all of this, right? It's neither of those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It is a manipulated environment. First of all, not every show is the same. They're all done differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the way she sets up the show within the show, which is called what?
Everlasting,
yeah.
Which is a great show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's totally what they would call Bachelor.
And the music is perfect.
Oh, the music is perfect. The way that they set up Everlasting, it's not just these people acting normal. And nobody is telling them what to say, per se.
Mm-hmm.
They're just being manipulated, and they're being goaded, and they're being fed. They're being fed certain ideas, and because they've been cast, partly because they are susceptible to that kind of manipulation, they're able to be, you know, they're able to be manipulated.
One of the nice things they've done with this show, and one thing that feels very true to seasons of The Bachelor that I have watched, is that the bachelor himself, or I'm sorry, the suitor himself, is a complete and utter D-bag.
Yeah.
And a specific kind of D-bag.
Yeah, he is.
And a specific kind of D-bag, opportunistic D-bag, who, I mean, really has been on The Bachelor before. But he's also hard to manipulate. Mm-hmm. He's also, in part, because he's so opportunistic and because he's so willful and kind of just does what he wants and doesn't necessarily, quote unquote, play by their rules, they have an interesting dynamic where she's accustomed to being able to manipulate people on this show, but has a really hard time with him.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting scene where she's watching playback of some interaction between the two of them and she gets surprised at herself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she sees the attraction and she gets very worried. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. It was great. And we should say the other running it with Sarah Gertrude Shapiro is Marty Noxon,
yes.
who's worked on Buffy and Angel and I think has worked in the Shondaverse and has worked in the... She's worked in kind of every superverse of TV producers and has kind of gone from place to place and tends to take a lot of crap about what she did, I think, on Buffy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think is a really experienced TV producer who probably is also bringing certain experiences, maybe not reality experiences, but certain experiences to bear.
Certainly a very, very interesting voice.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, really interesting show. I'll be interested to see what those of you who are listening think of it. Again, it's Unreal. It's on Lifetime. They've aired as we tape this 4 episodes. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So stick around.
Hi, I'm Mary Morrison, and I'm calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. This episode and the following message are made possible by Stamps.com. Stamps.com helps businesses avoid trips to the post office. With Stamps.com, use your own computer and printer to print official U.S. postage for any letter or package, and then the mailman picks it up. No more wasting time going to the post office. Use the promo code POPCULTURE for a special offer. A no-risk trial, plus a digital scale, and free postage. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and type in POPCULTURE. That's Stamps.com, enter POPCULTURE.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We have arrived at our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, my 14-year-old son has been, his plan is to binge watch all 30 seasons of Survivor.
Eventually.
Eventually. Uh-huh. Not all in one day.
Yeah. yeah.
And it's fascinating to relive these things that I watched religiously. I never missed an episode of in 30 seasons in 15 years. Years of Survivor, but to go back and see how things have changed in what I still think is an enormous, as much as the last few seasons of that show I think are very disappointing, it is such a sturdy conceit to see in the early seasons how they were really insistent upon putting a homophobe on like every season of that show and like the casual nasty like he's a queer and like he's lovable and salty to see the societal shifts that have occurred even within reality television in the last 15 years. So I keep walking into my living room and experiencing like, oh, you know what, I love Yule or oh my god, Yao Man from Fiji,
you bet.
You know, these lovable in some cases lovable and in some cases like, oh man, I have to time my descent into the living room for when this particular person is going to get eliminated so that I can watch the look on his smug face.
I know the rhythms.
You know? So that's been enormously fun to kind of, you know, enjoy secondhand and then to relive these things by talking about them with my kid. The other thing that I want to mention, as we've mentioned on the show many times before, I write an advice column for NPR Music called The Good Listener, and I need questions.
Awesome.
If you have questions, like one of the best recent questions that we have gotten in The Good Listener was written by one Margaret H. Willison, who is in the room with me, asking, can I deflate the beach balls that get thrown around at festivals? And it was the most curmudgeonly Weldonian grump letter.
And yet awesome.
And the comments just turned into an ecosystem of their own.
Gosh. They did. They were like, oh, you monster. Just don't go to concerts if you don't want to get hit with beach balls. I was like, well, all righty then.
But if
done
you want to join Margaret in the the annals of people who've submitted great questions to The Good Listener. If you have any question that you would love to see answered that is in any way music adjacent, we have set up an email address at NPR just for the purpose of gathering these questions. It is goodlistener@npr.org. And I would love, as the person who is constantly scraping
looking
for great evocative questions. So goodlistener@npr.org, please submit your questions.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three things I've talked about before on this show, but that was when they were purely theoretical. Now they are here, they're real, and they're spectacular. Penny Dreadful is deep into its second season. It is just engineered for people my age who are me. The writer Lewis Peitzman on Twitter said, "It's like if the song Monster Mash was gay porn." I can't top that, so I'm just going to back away. But pursuant to that observation, the third episode guest starred Patti LuPone as, wait for it, a witch. And, she just gnawed into that part, man. She was so... This was just such a great piece of TV. The second thing is a book that I loved is now a miniseries that I love. It's two episodes in, I think. It's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell on BBC America. It's a little broader in places, would you agree, Margaret?
I haven't watched it yet, but I'm very excited.
I gotta say, you didn't see Margaret make praise hands.
Yeah. It's just, I'm only two episodes in, but just the mood, the tone, everything, I just love it. And then finally, Batman Arkham Knight is is in my case a PS4 game that just came out. I have been waiting for it for a long time. It is in my bag. It just came today. I was looking out the window at the day job office, just pining, walking my lonely widow's walk. Waiting for the game to come,
yes.
Return from the sea.
Gotcha.
So yeah, now it's here and get started on that. So,
fantastic.
Three things.
I had a feeling.
Yep.
I had a feeling. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Margaret Willison, what is making you happy this week, Hula Hoop?
There's a certain category of actor that I think of as my bad guy boyfriends. Hmm. And they're usually British. They're usually wry. And they're usually aristocratic.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Yeah, you do. And the template setting actor for me in this category was George Sanders, mm-hmm. who's got a run of great movies in the 40s and 50s. Most notably, he plays Addison DeWitt in All About Eve.
Yeah.
If you're looking to watch
Shout
more,
out to Trey Graham.
Here to represent people who love aunts with big hats, always, me
right.
and Trey Graham.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, great actor, great personality. He wrote in the 70s a memoir called Autobiography of a Professional Cad. And it was completely out of print a couple of years ago, but I read about it on some old cinema blog, and I requested it through interlibrary borrowing at my academic library. As you would. And I read it, and I was so delighted by it that I strongly considered not returning it to the library.
What?
I was like, would Yale even miss it?
What?
Because it was completely out of print. You couldn't get it anywhere. The only copies of it were hundreds of dollars.
That is basically cannibalism.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Oh, my gosh.
Obviously, I did not do this because, you know, I have a moral code and mm-hmm. I follow it. Mm-hmm. But in my little review of it on Goodreads, I was like, if my life were a romantic comedy, the man who wanted to marry me would find a secondhand copy of this book and he would bring it to me. That would be the scene where we fell in together into each other's arms.
Right.
My reunion with this book is not quite as good as that. I'm not getting true love out of it. But my roommate Emeritus was searching around for a birthday present for me, and he happened to go onto Amazon and look it up, and this book is now magically back in print. And anybody with $15 in their pocket can buy it. You don't even have to steal it from Yale University. Go out. Get it. If you like Addison DeWitt, it is exactly the memoir you would expect him to write. It includes scenes like talking about his czarist Russian uncle spreading marmalade on the ceiling of his bedroom and shooting down the flies that came to eat it. One of many great scenes in this book. Really read it. Memoirs of a Professional Cad by George Sanders.
Thank you very much, Margaret Willison. We got so many outlets now, right? You got your Hulu, you got your Netflix, you got your Amazon. Every now and then, they just, something almost goes by because everything goes by so fast that it is hard to believe that I almost missed the beginning of Catastrophe, which is comedy series starring Rob Delaney and a woman named Sharon Horgan. And Catastrophe is just a little six episode, and they're only half an hour. I am savoring it. I'm only halfway through it because I don't actually want to binge watch it because I'm enjoying it so much. He plays an American who meets a woman in London, and they have sex, and she gets pregnant. And it is the most surprising thing in tone. If you follow Rob Delaney on Twitter.
Which you should.
You know that his whole thing is kind of being just like filthy and strange. And so, sorry, Rob Delaney, I don't know. Compliment, I think. In this series, he is a romantic comedy lead. And it is really surprising. It's not that it's not still a filthy show. It's still a really kind of frank show. It's still a really dirty show. But it's also built on a relationship between these people that's very warm and charming in a lot of ways. And you wouldn't really want to watch necessarily a romantic comedy between people who, I mean, to me, the romantic comedy between people who are monsters and you wouldn't like has kind of lost its luster. Mm-hmm. So we're back here to people who fundamentally are pretty likable. They're also grown-ups. It is not a romantic comedy in the sense of kind of adolescent flirtation grafted onto 30-year-olds. Mm-hmm. It is the way that you can imagine that two people who are grown adults might behave in a situation like this, in that they go back and forth between. Sometimes they're very happy about being together. Sometimes they're very reticent about being together. Sometimes they're in completely different places. Sometimes they are confronting entirely new stuff. So again, it's called Catastrophe. It's on Amazon. It's really interesting, and I very much have enjoyed the first half of it, and I am saving the, Rob Delaney would enjoy it if I said I'm saving the back half. I'm saving the back half of this show to enjoy at my leisure. Mm-hmm. So that is Catastrophe is on Amazon Prime streaming. So, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. That's MrsFridayNext, Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Helping us this week as well is Kiana Fitzgerald. You can follow her at Kiana Fitz. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. By the way, Mike now working for the lovely NPR show that we love so much, Ask Me Another. Yeah. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.